Greetings, friends. My name is Jessa McLean, and I'm here to provide you with some blueprints of disruption. This weekly podcast is dedicated to amplifying the work of activists, examining power structures, and sharing the success stories from the grassroots. Through these discussions, we hope to provide folks with the tools and the inspiration they need to start to dismantle capitalism, decolonize our spaces, and bring about the political revolution that we know we need.
Do you think she did any good?
Not a bit of good. Not a bit. I'd put a stake through her heart and garlic around her neck to make sure she never come back.
Isn't that a pretty horrible thing to say when her funeral's going on right now?
Too bad. Too bad.
Welcome back, John. In case folks missed your last episode, can you reintroduce yourself to our audience?
Yeah, I'm John Clark. I was a long-time organizer with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty for some 28 years, actually. I'm currently hold the position of PACA visitor in social justice at York University. Although with the strike going on, there's going to be some issues there as well. And that's basically my background, long-time anti-poverty activist and an organizer.
I called you on today because you were actually the first person that popped to my mind when I wanted to hash about the death of Brian Mulroney.
Yeah, I had a little time to get over the grief, so I'll be okay.
I didn't think you needed much space for that. When he died, the other thing that came to my mind was that video clip of an old woman under an umbrella being asked about Thatcher's death. And I don't be surprised if that actually ends up the intro to this episode, because not only did it validate the ability to speak ill of the dead, because we'll do that and justify that, but it was also a funny clip to watch. And normally I think people try to be a little bit more reserved about their criticisms, but I think when you have figures like Mulroney, there really is no space afforded to these folks in terms of glorifying their reigns. Even the most progressive articles I've read still give him a lot of room to appear as a great statesman. And so I think he's getting his dues all around. We're not going to really worry about that here. This will be a heavy critique of Mulroney, but also of neoliberalism. So John's also going to help us unpack neoliberalism, because we use that term a lot on the show to describe the politics of the day. We even call the NDP neoliberals. And I'm hoping folks will have a better understanding of just what we mean by that when we finish this episode, and why Mulroney was pivotal here in Canada and his comrades in the UK and the United States. So before I started recording, I asked John, you know, what do you want to talk about? And he went right to the kind of entrenchment of neoliberalism. Why is that, you know, the most pivotal thing about Mulroney for you?
Well, I think that Mulroney came in at a time when you had seen the kind of very sharp attacks that had been led by people like Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, and of course, not to forget their chum in Chile, Augusto Pinochet, who had sought to go about implementing what we'll define in a minute, but the neoliberal agenda, which we can just in shorthand at the moment call a period of greatly intensified exploitation. And so Mulroney made, I think, distinct contributions to that in some ways that are a little complicated, but really quite decisive. The whole idea, of course, of the agenda is to substantially reduce the role of the state in social provision. And Mulroney made enormous contributions to that with his cap on the Canada Assistance Plan, further assaults on unemployment insurance, a whole series of social spending measures. I would have to acknowledge, however, that he was a little more stealthy than Reagan and Thatcher in that regard. In fact, I remember at the time the term austerity by stealth was being bandied around. So he was a little more cautious and a little more incremental on that front than the real neoliberal dragons.
Especially if you contrast that to the rhetoric Thatcher and Reagan used outwardly, the phrases most famously coined by that, you know, there is no society, and
yes,
pulling folks up by their bootstraps. I mean, it was really overt, that kind of hatred of the social safety nets.
Yes, I mean, I would say that Reagan was a sort of was fronting an operation and probably wasn't that decisive a figure in his own right, but his presidency was very significant. Thatcher was an ideologue of the most reactionary kind, a very determined and forceful individual. And yeah, she was ideologically zealous, as were the people behind Reagan. I think Mulroney was a bit more concerned about his meal ticket and popularity and such like, and was not quite the warrior that they were. But he still, during his period, made significant contributions to the dismantling of the social infrastructure in this country and set the stage for the decisive moves that were actually made by the Liberals following that under Chrétien and Martin. So he was very much part of that process. But of course, it was in the area of free trade, that other great element of neoliberalism, of deregulating as much as possible, removing all restrictions on the flow of capital. And so the weakening, not the weakening of the state, I think that's a mistake to say, but the weakening of the state function that sort of regulated and contained capitalism's worst instincts was actually, he played the lion's role in actually furthering that agenda and promoting the whole free trade direction. So his contribution to the neoliberal order on that front was absolutely cutting edge.
It bothers me that part of the definition that you thankfully clarified, but where it's reducing the functions of the state, certain functions.
Yes.
Right, because the act of signing free trade agreements, even the deregulation, but it's fluid. It's always dependent on what they need. If they need high regulation in order to secure something, they will get it. You know, if it means competing with a different market. So their fingers, so it's not the fingers of the invisible hand of the market. The government plays a huge role in neoliberalism. But, you know, when you read the kind of dry definition that's provided of neoliberalism, it does really focus on lowering government spending and that libertarian view that is very popular at the moment, where the government shouldn't play a role in my life. But it's also paired with usually heavy reinforcement of police militarization. Absolutely. Because, you know, you stomp on people long enough, you're going to have to keep them down. And so that's quite the misnomer when people talk about neoliberalism.
No, I think that's an essential thing to grasp. I mean, you've cited it already, but the infamous interview that Margaret Thatcher gave to Women's Own magazine it was actually in 1987, when she made this infamous comment that there's no such thing as society. I mean, she's capable of saying that, but of course, what she really means when she's referring to the state function is getting the state out of the secondary area of reluctant social provision. As I said recently in something I wrote, you know, Margaret Thatcher certainly wasn't a prison abolitionist. And when she needed to send in warships, that was fine. And if employers wanted their strike picket lines smashed, she certainly didn't tell them the state can't send you in police forces. You know, you've got to learn to stand on your own two feet. I mean, she was a robust believer in her kind of society.
And they weren't any more skilled or aren't any more skilled in balancing the budget or reducing government spending after all. Like after when we look at the actual spending of the same people who reduce red tape, like that's what deregulation is often sold as. Yes. The language they use is reducing red tape. But in the end, it usually ends up costing us because they remove fees and other ways of revenue for the government at the same time. And so it's hard for people to truly understand neoliberalism without kind of also looking at the global view that's attached to it, right? The role that free trade is, because it kind of contrasts your current conservative rhetoric that is anti-globalization. And I know they don't mean capital. Well, the foreign investors, that's quite popular right now, the focusing on foreign investors as kind of like the worst part of globalization, or perhaps the UN is a target now. But really, when you talk about neoliberalism and that globalization, it's that free move of capital across borders. And then I always kind of juxtaposition that with the restriction on people on those same borders. This neoliberal ideology is full of contradictions that I think it are worth pointing out, but maybe help people understand why free trade is a bad thing, because that's another thing that gets a great label. It doesn't sound bad.
No, I mean, they always put a, you know, free trade is a very, I mean, the name is the name itself is calculated to be an appealing name. But I mean, it essentially means that, I mean, you made the point, I think, exactly that, you know, there is to be the ability of capital to move in an unrestricted way. So for jobs to be moved offshore or investments to be moved around is absolutely critical to it. And the movement of people is of course, substantially more restricted. So, but I mean, under that kind of liberalized system, and using liberal in the sense of freeing up capital, not in the sense of nice values, under that system, the global workforce has been completely reorganized in ways that are absolutely staggering. Not only has there been movement of jobs offshore from the wealthier countries to the poorest countries, but they've been able to establish a global supply chain, a just-in-time supply chain that literally draws from the most exploited people everywhere on the planet and assembles the component parts. And so, I mean, there's been an incredible change in the global workforce. What Mulroney was a pioneer of has moved in ways that probably at the time he couldn't even have begun to imagine the enormity of what he was consciously unleashing.
Yeah, he really reshaped the Canadian economy in a way that we lost tons of jobs.
Yes.
On top of that, you talk about the exploitation of foreign labor, but also domestic labor as well, right? It frames any barrier, and that includes like labor costs and workers' rights. And Mulroney had particular disdain for unions, didn't he?
Yes. I mean, he was very instrumental in the intensifying attack on trade unions that has taken place since the 1970s, and played a very big role. The assault on public sector unions, but private sector unions as well. Absolutely, Mulroney was part of a continuing process of moving from a relatively adequate system of so-called labor relations to moving towards something that's more and more restrictive.
I've got a whole list in front of me of things that we can credit Mulroney for, and also things that people are trying to give him credit for that I feel like perhaps are misplaced. I'm going to start there because Mayor Olivia Chow, she sent her condolences. She tweeted out, as well as every other politician, but the progressive ones I always particularly come after because I should hold them to a better regard. I mean, I'm really annoyed. She could have sent out any kind of mundane statement, John, you know, like he was a great statesman. He contributed to the country, like really vague. The CBC kind of did a headline that you could borderline get away with. But she chose to actually credit him with ending acid rain and apartheid in South Africa, completely erasing all of the work done on the ground that put the political pressure on, completely ignoring the kind of political situation that happened at the time. Like apartheid at the time of Mulroney was going down. It was popular. It was detriment to capital. Let's just start there. Do you want to vent about that for a second? Because that really pissed me off coming from Olivia, who has a history of grassroots organizing.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a huge difference between someone who was appalled by the intense racism and gross exploitation of apartheid and took up a struggle to bring it to an end because it was vile and morally disgusting and what have you, to a statesman type who sort of got on board, as you absolutely correctly say, I think, when the writing was on the wall for the apartheid system. It was coming to an end. It had lost its credibility. Wide sections of global and South African capital were fully aware of the fact that they needed to jettison that system and implement the neoliberal agenda in South Africa, which they did brutally, in ways that dispensed with the formalities of apartheid, but maintained the gross exploitation of black workers in South Africa. So they got to give up their cake, but eat it as well in that sense. And that was, I think, Mulroney was very much part of that process of, I don't think he was a genius, but he had a good, solid instinct of which way the wind was blowing. And so I think he got on side and joined the sort of the cheering section of apartheid must go down when it was in the interests of the class that he served to do just that.
I'm glad you brought that point up about the exportation of neoliberalism. two other states. Because I think when I learned about neoliberalism in school, this was the part that was driven home to me, or at least the part that stuck, because it's often sold as democracy. It's often under the pretext that a liberal democracy or neoliberal democracy will bring justness, prosperity to its people. It is the end goal of all foreign relations in imperial states, right? Like Canada's goal is to spread democracy. The U.S.'s claims like that is its goal. And so it permeates into countries often, sometimes under economic aid, but always with the same kind of liberal democracy framework. And then that is the victory, right? Then the economic exploitation seems to go unnoticed because they can vote.
Yes.
They can vote now. And so that is the be all end all of the savior. They can move on, right? And like you say, the economic exploitation is intensified.
Yes, I mean they always want to. Legitimacy is a major question for them. They always want to preserve that the facade that would enable them to preserve legitimacy. And democracy is their watchword. But the striking thing about democracy is that, provided the vote goes the way they want, they are great champions of democracy. But if anybody disagrees, and usually disagrees around how much exploitation of the people and resources of that oppressed country can take place, then suddenly the democracy goes out the window. Right now in Haiti, they're preparing yet another intervention. And this is supposedly to deal with, you know, restore the rule of law and all this stuff. But in fact, democracy was beginning to take root in Haiti under Aristide. And they had a government that was beginning to respond to the popular will and was beginning to put limits on the exploitative process. And a meeting between essentially French, US and Canadian capitalist interests and political representatives was brokered in Ottawa. And Aristide ended up being put on a plane by U.S. Marines and sent out of the country, the first democratically elected president of the country. So, I mean, that's their commitment to nation building and democratic values, is provided it brings them in profits, they're all for it. But if it works out in ways they don't like, then they're a bit of authoritarianism is just fine with them.
Yeah, the whole system's built with hypocrisies, and it's just built into. But it's essential to point them out. I want to talk about, let's go back to Mulroney. I'm going to keep drawing us back. We're going to keep shitting on him, John. He's not off the hook. A lot of people look at GST as one of his achievements. And I've seen some even a little bit of discourse online between progressives about the introduction of the GST. Do you have any thoughts on a regressive tax like the GST versus an income tax? Because I would look at the GST as not an achievement, as something that ends up taxing the poor more. And so I don't like it included on his fucking obituary.
No, I think that's entirely correct and entirely fair. I mean, the whole idea of putting a tax on consumer goods is that, you know, as they say, the poor pay more. You're going to have a standard rate that everybody that needs to buy these items has to pay, and it's going to come out of the pockets of poor people. And I mean, it's not just that shift over to the GST type strategy was taking place. At the same time, progressively, the banks, the corporations, the personally wealthy were paying less and less tax. So the GST was a compensation for the giveaway to the rich that was taking place. And I don't think anyone can delude themselves that it was anything other than that.
It's frustrating to see how a lot of these issues are being reframed, you know, from the advocacy for South Africa to some of the even economic policies. There's even an article in Rabble that really goes on at some length to the achievements of Mulroney. And that's really hard to swallow in this time, because I think he's had his whole lifetime for people to give him false accolades and to blow smoke up his ass. And I think when he comes back in the news, if it's for his death, it's ample time to actually be honest with the long-term impacts, because that's also what's missing from the glowing tributes that acknowledge, you know, they kind of wash over free trade, you know, I'll give them that, but they don't, the obvious economic impacts, the growing inequality that has skyrocketed since the introduction of neoliberalism. It's manifestation in politics still, you know, it's like hyper-capitalism is a kind of a way to describe it as well. Is there anything else like part of his legacy that really stands out in terms of economics? For me, well, I'm going to jump in. Sorry, so we don't forget about it. The selling off of crown corporations. Yeah. That is a trend that still continues to this day. It's a wave we've not yet been able to push back in any really meaningful way. I don't know what we have left. You know, it's to the point where even they're looking to the post office to turn a dollar in order to justify itself. It's like nothing is seen as a service that has value anymore. Everything is in terms of making profit. But even then, we've lost some serious money selling off these crown corporations. I think some people would be surprised to know some of these used to be owned, because we're talking about from 1984 to 1993. That's why I called you in, John. I was a kid, but my producer, Santiago, he wasn't even born yet. So we definitely had to go over this. It's a history lesson a little bit. But, you know, Air Canada, the Connaught Laboratories, we used to own the pharmaceutical company, you know, that could have created vaccines for Canadians. Yeah. The list is long. I think it's like 23.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you say that, I mean, in yet another area, I think it's almost like the implementation of the regressive agenda has been a relay race. And so within every one of these cases, it's you can see what Mulroney did on his several laps around the stadium. And yes, he contributed to all of the things that have made life worse for us. I mean, I think that's the fundamental point about him. And so I think he has to be assessed that way. And I think it's really quite sad that you get, you know, I'm not surprised. I mean, I wouldn't single out Olivia Chow for this sin any more than most of them. Jagmeet Singh has done exactly the same kind of, you know, not just a sort of a terse, supposed to say the right thing, but a sort of a lavish, I don't know what he really thinks, but he feels the need publicly to sort of pay a sort of a groveling homage to Mulroney.
Why do they do that, John? Why can't they just not say anything? Like, do they think there'd be a lot of backlash? Or do they really look to him like that, you think? Like, what is going on?
My honest opinion is that it's actually a bit of both. They have this sort of electoralist view that, you know, we don't want to offend people by being too jarring. And if we appear too radical and we say nasty things about Mulroney, that's some people who won't vote for us, although maybe some people who would, but that's another question. On the other hand, I think it's sort of they mean it, I think. I think they really mean it. I think they see themselves as part of the same club. You know, and they're supposed to be a bit to the left and a bit more critical, and they disagree with Mulroney's in some ways, but they see him as an honoured member of the club that they're part of. And so I think it's the rottenness of parliamentarianism. I think it actually gets you to that point where, you know, Mulroney is someone, yes, you'd spar with him on the floor of the House of Commons, perhaps if you were in a position to, and you'd disagree with him and you'd say cutting things in the media scrums. But at the end of the day, you'd exchange friendly words in the corridors and even go for drinky poos. I mean, that's just that kind of world that they're part of. And I think they reflect that. You know, I go off on a tangent here, but there was, I've never forgotten this. Some years ago when Bob Rae was the leader of the NDP opposition in Ontario, I was in the gallery of the legislature with some people from various anti-poverty organizations. And there was this woman from Kitchener who I remember like thought Bob Rae was just such a champion of the people and, you know, so ready to, so she just admired him so much. And so the thing hadn't started yet. They're just sitting around waiting for the speaker to come in with the silly mace or whatever it is. And so at that moment, Bob Nixon, the Liberal treasurer, is sitting on the other side, and Rae calls something out to him and then walks over, and then they start play boxing and patting each other on the back. And I look around at this woman from Kitchener, she goes, "My God, they're friends. They like each other." You know, and she was so horrified by watching that take place that she actually she actually took off. She actually didn't stay with the movement anymore. She was so devastated by this experience. But I mean, she was revolted, and she had a right to be revolted. I mean, why would somebody that's supposed to represent working class people have anything but hatred and contempt for the people that sit on the other side? But to say that, they would say, oh, no. And so it's a very, very real consideration. It's a real weakness. I'd like to, if we were going to put people in those places as our representatives, I'd like to think they would have, you know, they would be cold and hostile to our class enemies. But that's not what we've got at the moment.
I grinned when you started retelling that story, because I pictured you kind of walking into a pub and seeing Mulrooney sitting at the bar, and I'll just let myself daydream how that interaction might have turned out, but I don't think you'd be buying him a pint.
The one meeting I was involved with in with Mulrooney, he told me that he didn't have to put up with my diatribes. So,
he's probably he actually did.
He did, I insisted.
I will subject you either way. We obviously can't talk about Mulrooney without talking about brown envelopes of cash, right? If we're just going to have dripping disdain for the rich, when go all in. And I didn't know. So, okay, our audience might not even know what we're talking about. Mulrooney, do I have to say alleged? It was reported Mulrooney took $300,000 from a Karl-Heinz Schreiber. He's a German businessman that wanted to build a weapons manufacturer, yay, in Quebec. And he thought Mulrooney could help him with it or whatever. Someone, Schreiber says, funny enough, well, funny for me, that Mulrooney's chief of staff came to him and said, Mulrooney's hard up for cash right now. And so Schreiber was like, okay, I'll pay him to grease some wheels and get my factory. It seemed like a kind of tit for tat. I imagine this thing goes on all the time. The way that they describe it, it just seems like it's just normal for them to just pass cash back and forth for favors and whatnot. But not only did he have all that surrounding him, but he ended up getting $2.1 million from the Canadian government as part of a settlement on that. And then after that settlement, it comes out that he pretty much did have dealings with this Schreiber, even though he swore up and down he didn't, in order to get that settlement. And did you know, John, this is a little fact I found out like 5 minutes before we logged on. So the Justice Department actually looked into getting that money back from Mulrooney, that $2.1 million. The only thing you can find on that afterwards is the RCMP just shut that shit down. They're like, no, you're not. All right, you're not. You don't have any evidence. It's not happening. We're not doing it. So, move on. And so, not only did he get the $300K and then never did help Schreiber, we don't think, but he got $2.1 million. Like he needed it. That should be in his obituary, don't you think?
Yes, the softer side of public service is definitely a consideration. But I mean, I think that's. I mean, again, it reflects the whole hypocrisy and injustice of this world that these people live in, where, I mean, not only do nefarious goings on take place, that if indiscretions of a fraction of the same degree were carried out by working class people or poor people living on social assistance, they'd be vilified and put in prison. Those things, I mean, the RCMP doesn't surprise me for a moment. The RCMP would say, we're not touching him, leave him alone. He's too big to fail. That's really part of how the system works. But not only do these people get to immerse themselves in self-aggrandizement and self-gain and undue access to privilege and wealth, but at the end of the day, they come out as these sort of, they come out as praised individuals, even icons. And that's what's absolutely incredible. And frankly, if Mulrooney took some brown paper envelopes full of cash and stuck them in a safe, that's really the least of what he did. You know, I mean, the harm that he did to people was enormous. And why should we for a moment put up with this deification, this praising of him? Oh, he's a human being. He died. And maybe for some people around him, that's a personal tragedy. And I'm not looking to be crass. But he was a public figure. He was a political leader whose actions hurt lots of people. And I don't think we should be at all shy about offering an honest and highly critical and even very hostile analysis of Brian Mulroney the political figure?
I'm sure a lot of Indigenous folks and allies were looking at the Oka crisis.
Right.
As well as another part of Mulroney's huge legacy that is still standing. I'll link the article because I do forget the author's name. But they describe Mulroney as being the one who held the line on settler colonialism with his response to the Oka crisis. And we can see that kind of replicated in Ontario with Land Back Lane and the response that politicians have when it comes to land claims, treaty rights, and developer needs. And, you know, to watch that happen on a scale that it did, and he didn't face a whole lot of political repercussion in the end, it really did set a standard there that hasn't really been reckoned with either. I wanted to make sure that we also talk about another one of his lasting impacts that is being felt and also meets the needs that we need to keep talking about Palestine. Mulroney was a huge supporter of Israel. Here's actually a quote from Mulroney's memoir. On the belief that the Jews, having suffered horribly over generations, have found a permanent home in a tangible, defined Israel, and that they alone must make value judgments in respect of their national security. So much to unpack in that statement. Like, you could have an entire, I think, discussion on unpacking the assumptions made there, the erasure of the occupation. But to see now that the world is essentially operating like that, where it's not their place at all, like international law is just a mere convenience, not applied to our allies, right? It's only there for when we need to weaponize it. But he really did defend. Like, during the first Intifada, Mulroney was the one that kept pushing back at anybody trying to restrain Israel and their heavy-handed military response. He obviously wasn't very vocal during this last crisis, but we can only imagine where he would stand there. And it really solidified a lot of relationships that we have with Israel now. One that we're really trying to disrupt is the ties that we have with their weapons industry. It's all couched under research and development of high technology. But those are the same companies. Mulroney was responsible for really establishing trade agreements there and those ties that now result in a lot of Canadian companies supplying arms to Israel, amongst our other supports. But it's funny to have people celebrating him as ending apartheid, but at the same time knowing he stood fast for, you know, the same colonial violence in Israel.
I mean, if I could say, I think that the fact that you raise Oka and then you raise Palestine is actually very telling, because Mulroney had to. There was a huge crisis. Mohawk resistance created a huge crisis, and the support that existed for Mohawk resistance created a huge crisis for the Canadian state. There's no doubt about it. But it would be absurd to present Mulroney, the deployer of federal troops. It would be absurd to present him as some kind of champion of the rights of Mohawk people. Any concessions made in that period, very limited ones, were not made with good grace. I can remember during the Oka crisis, and we're talking about the Mohawk Nation, which has members of its nation living, members of that nation live on both sides of the US-Canadian border. And I remember Mulroney making this big contemptuous statement about many of these people are not even real Canadians, which sort of really expressed his sort of like disgusting ignorance and arrogance when it came to Indigenous identity and Indigenous nationhood. And he's the Prime Minister of a country where that has been based on the dispossession of those Indigenous nations. And his just glaring ignorance and contempt is just shocking. And so too, the quote that you gave, I mean, fundamentally to him, the Palestinians are nothing. They're just a dispossessed people, and that their rights are non-existent. Even their existence isn't taken into account, and everything's been based on that, based on absolutely sort of racist ideology, but also based on the needs of Canadian capital, which has obviously always seen the creation of the of Israel as being a strategic asset and an enormous benefit to it. So Mulroney, not surprisingly, the same theme emerges with regards to Palestine. Mulroney was part of that developing process of ongoing Western support for the settler colonial regime in the Middle East. He was a way station in an agenda that's gotten worse and is still continuing and is playing out with unimaginable horror at the moment in Gaza.
And the Canadian government still utilizes that free trade as a way to aid nations, right? So they're suggesting increased free trade with Israel, trying to sign free trade agreements with Ukraine, and often the presence of a liberal type democracy within Israel is used to legitimize the state. So all of these, our discussion on like neoliberalism and the impacts of Mulroney and the colonial state, you end up finding that all these things are actually quite tied together. I wonder, are you going to lose any sleep if anyone disrupts his state funeral on March 23rd in Montreal? Do you think that's appropriate?
Would it be appropriate? I mean, I don't know what plans exist. I my personal view would be, if they choose to make this man's passing a major propaganda opportunity and a major way of promoting those values, then it becomes, as far as I'm concerned, a public event. If Mulroney was being discreetly laid to rest by the people closest to him, that might be a different question. But they choose to make it a public display. So if they've created the circus, I don't think they can be too upset if somebody jumps in the ring.
I personally think it would be justified and, for me, welcomed, because I think it's time we really push back against the way we honor political elites. Even our own, we tend to shield them from criticism and whatnot because they're our political elites and they're revered. And it really interprets the way we vote, the way we see representation, that it's above us, beyond us, you know, for other people, richer people. It's the same with the royal weddings and funerals and on the money. It seems like such an insignificant issue to address and perhaps like really maybe superficial, but it's rooted in the ideology that holds the working class back, right? That realization that they're not materially different than us other than their income status. Like there is...
I mean, I think the sort of notion that there's an obligatory reverence for the fallen heroes of the establishment is, for one thing, apart from anything else, it's enormously selective and hypocritical, right? Because if someone that they perceive to be an enemy is to kick the bucket, then there isn't any hesitation in piling on and denouncing them. You know, when Chavez died in Venezuela, there was no sort of rule that you had to say dignified, nice things about him. If Vladimir Putin, and I'm certainly not an admirer of Vladimir Putin, but he's an enemy of the establishment in the West. And if he died tomorrow, they'd be letting off fireworks. They'd be celebrating like crazy. So this notion that you don't speak ill of the dead is anyway hypocrisy. But the other thing about it is that when these characters croak, they absolutely use it as an opportunity to shore up and praise the system, right?
In even ways the GST, right? They're even trying to, this is a time to be like, this was always a great idea.
Absolutely. And but to legitimize the system, you know, to create this sympathetic figure. And it sometimes it's their politicians, it's royal family, it's prominent people. If God forbid anything should happen to him, but if Elon Musk was to come to harm, there would be this outpouring of what a wonderful man he was, a bit complicated, but a wonderful man. And no, I mean, I think it's completely appropriate that we offer a hostile critique of the public and political role that these people played. Issues of private grief aside, that's not the point. The point is they were public figures and they have to be dealt with as such. And moreover, I think it's part of, we've already touched on it, but I think it's part of that rotten parliamentarianism, the notion that in the end, you know, we can disagree, but in the end, we're all part of the same grouping. We're all part of the same loyal club. And we all say nice things about each other when we go in the dirt. And I just think it's just disgusting. I think we need some hatred, for God's sake. We need some rage. We need to hold these people accountable. Can't we at least despise them? I mean, if we can't manage to even do that, what's wrong with us? I mean, they had nothing but hatred and contempt for working class people. Why shouldn't we return the favor?
I never understood that at all. I think some people would label it as respectability politics. And yeah, no doubt, like if you're going into a normal conversation, you don't want to go in hostile or even perhaps a somewhat level negotiation with one of your comrades, one of your community members. There's a way to deal with people respectively. But you're talking about an immense power struggle that exists here. And I think we forget that that is our ruling class, like the impact that they have over us. And the failure of some people to even identify that we're in a class war is part of that. But the toxic parliamentarianism, yeah, it's like something happens to people when they go in there. And the folks that don't kind of play by those respectability politics, they don't seem to kind of float close enough to the sun to actually make much of a difference. And it just, I don't know, a story popped in my head and it relates to here I'm ruled by a Mulrooney. Carolyn Mulrooney is my MPP. So
my condolences.
Thank you. I was going to say I'll accept your condolences, but you were kind enough to offer them without that. So you do know my pain. And we all hate Ben Mulrooney. So it's like it's a family game. But when, you know, we lost an election to her, I was working on that campaign and Brian Mulrooney was even there stumping. He went to all the seniors' homes in the area and glad handed everybody, even though that he had destroyed their pensions. And so, you know, I had an axe to grind there. But then I ran as a candidate in another election. I didn't have to deal with a Mulrooney. I won't mention who I lost to. It was horrible. But I was told to call them. I was a campaign manager on the NDP campaign against Mulrooney. And someone said, has Dave called? Like, has the candidate called to congratulate Mulrooney? And I was like, why the fuck would he do that? They do that? They do that? It was like my first real campaign. They're like, yeah. And I was like, well, I'm not telling him to do that. You can go tell him to do that. I'm not telling him to do that. And then when it was my turn, it was like my team was not happy with me. They were like, you have to call and congratulate them. And I go, congratulate our class enemy. You want me to call a man who would destroy every social safety net we had, who pretty much spits on Indigenous rights. Like, you know, I went on a little diatribe, obviously. I was like, you want me to call him and congratulate him? No, no, no. And they're just like, you'll never go anywhere in politics. I'm like, probably not then. Because that's ridiculous. Like, I was just so, and I was like, you guys know me. Like, I had only friends and family really working on that campaign. Like, they know my disdain for the ruling class. Like, I've known the real enemy since I was a child, right? Like, I grew up in a socialist household. Like, it was not, I was so puzzled by their reaction and their willingness to play like certain games within the political realm. That's what really, in politics, there's all kinds of examples of things you're supposed to do and how to climb the ladder. And it really does reshape how you see the class war, right? Like, yeah, you start considering having beers with those people, then you've lost focus. And then you're not standing up and making a big fucking scene in the parliament when I need you to be making a scene and really going after the people you need to go after, because you're holding back, right? Mm-hmm. You're worried about appearances. You're worried about dealing with them in the hallway or whatever you're worried about. But yeah, it really kind of takes the teeth out of people.
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned this before, but they have this notion that you use the term the politics of respectability. It's a very apt term. But in truth, I mean, I think they're actually miscalculating, apart from their own allegiances. I think just from a tactical point of view, they are actually making a serious miscalculation because they live in this bubble. I mean, back in Britain, the parliament is referred to as the Westminster bubble. And that's very much what frames their ideas. But in fact, I would say to display hostility to those enemies would actually win them enormous respect in the working class. I mean, the story I told about the woman in the Ontario legislature being appalled by the friendship and cordiality that the NDP leader was displaying, I think that's very, very, very typical. I think if somebody, instead of saying, you know, if some NDP politician came forward and said, look, I don't wish to be crass. A man has died. He has family. There's personal grief. But in terms of his public role, I'm not going to pretend for a moment that Brian Mulroney was our friend or someone whose political life I want to celebrate. He was an enemy for the following reasons, and it's necessary to appraise him in that way. You don't have to be, you know, you don't have to sort of...
I would be so excited to hear something like that, John. Yeah. I would be sharing that. All would. It would...
And you don't have to be. You don't have to be crass. You know, you don't have to wear a party hat and dance on his grave or something. Although, if you want to, that's fine with me. But you could be measured. You could be restrained. You don't have to. But you could be frank. You could be honest. You could offer a political appraisal of an enemy who has died, and that's what should happen. But
I didn't see one. Did you see one?
And you'll never see it. I mean, the one. This is also an example from Britain, but this is a great one. The veteran Labour MP Dennis Skinner, who was the most ready to sort of show class sort of allegiance and class hatred. There was a great story told by some senior Tory who says he was walking down through the corridors in Westminster, and he said, "I bumped into Dennis Skinner." And he's still a beast, he said. He said he's 80 something. And I just said to him, "Dennis, happy birthday." And he said to me, "Piss off, Tory boy." And we could use a bit of that.
Yeah, I would love to see a lot less filter on our politicians, because I think some of them go in there with a little bit more of a firebrand, and it's diminished, right?
Yeah.
They do live in a little bit out of touch, especially now. Like, the anger in people is palpable. And if you're not going to reflect that, there's nothing much that distinguishes you from the rest of the ruling class either. It's really hard to say they're not all the same, right? Isn't that, I mean, I say it all the time. Politicians are all the same. The parties, they're not all exactly the same. But, you know, that rhetoric is used a lot. Why would I vote? What difference does it make? And then when you see them all chumming it up and all paying respects to a man who ushered in vampire capitalism, then you're just so disheartened, right? I think on top of Gaza, but everything, just things keep happening where fewer and fewer people have any right to believe that the elected have anything in their best interest.
That sense that they are all the same is very deep. And I don't think it's correct as a, you know, precise appraisal, but I think you have to recognize there's a pretty significant grain of truth in what's said. So there's, of course, a difference between the Tories and the NDP, and a very significant difference. But I think the NDP leadership could work a little harder on opening up yet more space. I think there's plenty of room to do better in that regard. And we're talking about, I mean, we're talking about the way they deal with the fallen heroes of the establishment, but that's only symptomatic of a broader politics of adaption and compromise and collaboration that cuts very, very, very deep.
That's right, yeah, the capitulations. One of the major ideologies Mulroney, and especially Thatcher, as we spoke earlier, about bootstraps, is that idea of individualism. And now it's more... has almost a political name in libertarianism, which is full of hypocrisies in itself. We're not going to unpack those. But that idea that everyone should fend for themselves, that is responsible for themselves and their situation, right? Good or bad, right? It is a reflection of their character, their abilities, their value as a human being. And the absorption of that mentality into the working class, I think, sometimes is more damaging than the policies that we face, because it's a barrier to solidarity.
Yes.
And without solidarity, we have nothing. So, I mean, you would say he did that a little more stealthily because, you know, when you introduce austerity, quite often, that's the premise, right? Everyone should just be subjected to the market, right? The market will take care of you, take care of us. It's the best way to distribute services and goods. And we know that's not true. That era of neoliberalism that he was a part of certainly did kind of really drive that kind of idea home into the Canadian mindset. When it comes to individualism versus communitarianism, do you find that that is a huge barrier to organizing in terms of appealing to those who have been swept up by populism, the wrong kind of populism? I mean,
it's a fundamental problem within the working class under capitalism before you even get to the recent decades, right? Because the simple reality is that, you know, I mean, if you've ever gone for a job and you did an interview or applied, filled in a form, whatever you did, you were trying to get that job, which meant, whether you like it or not, that you were trying to make sure that somebody else didn't get that job, right? And so that competitive role amongst workers for jobs, that ability to sell their commodity and make sure somebody else doesn't sell their commodity in their place, is actually part of working class life, right? So that role of individualism is actually part of the system and part of class reality. And everything that happens, everything that's happened in recent decades has looked to intensify that sense of individualism and that denial of common interests and class interests. And, you know, I mean, Thatcher's statement, it seems like a sort of just a silly thing to say there's no such thing as society. It's so palpably absurd. But she was striking at something really, really significant with that point, that, you know, the self-interested individual will come out on top, even if they have to cross picket lines, rat their fellow workers out to the boss, whatever it is, they'll do all right. And the person who didn't make it, who's in the gutter, you just regard with contempt and walk over them and move on and continue to live your own life. But all of the real gains that we've made have been by rejecting that ideology. And it's been intensified during the recent decades. And that sense of collective identity, common interest, and working class solidarity is at the heart of everything. That's not to say there isn't a role for individual people and individual rights. And of course, that's very valid. But the sense of community and working class solidarity is something that needs to be strengthened considerably if we're going to move forward and if we're going to fight back against what we face.
Part of building that into the system too is when we're subjected to the market, right?
Yeah.
Society is erased in a way because we are all competing for the last on the shelf as well as the job. And there's just so many different ideologies inherent in capitalism and neoliberalism that need to be unpacked, because I think sometimes we absorb them without knowing. You know, you hear it reflected in people's language. And so for me now, I catch it because of how I think. But I think there's a lot of people who would not consider themselves as individualistic. That almost comes off as selfish. But it's just really been ingrained in how we operate, because I wouldn't even have thought as applying for a job as a way of competing. But of course it is.
Yeah.
Of course it is.
You've got to apply for jobs, isn't it? but no,
there's X amount and you need to come out on top. And yeah, it really is built into so many parts of our lives, that the idea of competition. Yeah. But in terms of Mulroney or neoliberalism, do you think there's any points that we missed?
No, I think the only thing I'd say is I'd reiterate the fact that the neoliberal turn was a fundamental turn for global capitalism, right? The era of relative compromise came to an end and was replaced by an assault. And I think we need to recognize that Mulroney was laying foundations in an earlier period. But if we look at what's happening now across the world, we look at the onset of global rivalry, we look at the absolute appalling genocide unfolding in Gaza, we look at the fact that working class people are actually taking to the streets, but the other side is so determined and intransigent to hold the line that we're up against a major challenge. So we need to understand Mulroney as someone who laid the foundations for a structure that we're now confronting, or helped lay the foundations for a structure that we're now confronting. So his legacy is one of a very, very significant bitter enemy of everything we need to do and everything we should stand for. And we should evaluate his life in that way, not necessarily with a sense of personal hatred, although animosity is totally in order. But we should recognize him as a class enemy that stood for something that we hate, that we despise, and we seek to defeat. If we do that, I think we've got a healthy perspective on the life and times of old, poor old Brian Mulroney, now that he's gone to his reward.
Join Reagan and Thatcher.
Join Reagan and Thatcher. And I'm sure they'll just be, well, I won't elaborate.
That is a wrap on another episode of Blueprints of Disruption. Thank you for joining us. Also, a very big thank you to the producer of our show, Santiago Helu Quintero. Blueprints of Disruption is an independent production operated cooperatively. You can follow us on Twitter at BP of Disruption. If you'd like to help us continue disrupting the status quo, please share our content. And if you have the means, consider becoming a patron. Not only does our support come from the progressive community, so does our content. So reach out to us and let us know what or who we should be amplifying. So until next time, keep disrupting.